All right, well, my first year out of college, I got a job working for Dell Computers. So, finished college, moved to Waco, and I got a job working in McGregor. They had a call center. Dell had a call center in McGregor, no longer there. And this was back in the era when you would call a 1-800 number, like 1-800-BUY-DELL or something, and you would describe the type of computer you want over the phone, and you just hope the person is putting that computer together on the other end and they ship it to you. I can't believe this is the way the world worked then, but that's the way the world worked, right? Like, you were just like, all right, I assume you're gonna do these things. And so I start working for this this company this way, and all of the salespeople were on commission. So everything you did mattered. The way your work at work impacted your livelihood. And so every single day in the morning, they would have these morning meetings to kick off the day to debrief yesterday's metrics. And so we would kick off the day and we would look at our team's metrics, and there's about 10 people on the team. And every single day you see, here's where our specific team stacked. And every single day, Chad was at the top of the lead of the team. Chad was always winning. He was always selling 10 to 12 computers every single day. And man, I do not like Chads. I don't like Chads. Chad? In my mind, I see you and I go, Charlie? Can I just call you Charlie? Because I just, This Chad was always selling. He was selling like $30,000 worth of computers every single day. And I was so happy when someone would call and they would actually want to buy ink. And I'd sell them ink for $50. Because a lot of my phone calls were people were like, I just wanted to talk. And I was like, oh, that's fun. Let's chat. So our management team pulled me aside. They're like, hey, Slim, you're at last place on this team that's the worst in our division. And we're the worst call center in all of Dell. So in a sense, you're the worst in all of Dell. Like, this is the hard talking to I had to hear. And I was like, cool. So what do we have to do? So they gave me all these plans and ways to improve. And I just was like, okay. And so I went from the worst salesperson in all of Dell to the top salesman in all of Dell, where they brought me down to Austin and they presented me with an award. And they're like, you did it. And it was like this moment of like glory, of like achievement, of you've arrived. And at the time I was like, I hate this so much. Because I felt like I just sold my soul to the devil to learn how to sell like that. I just was like, I don't like it. And I also didn't like how you had to do that, but I also didn't like that what it was doing to my body, what it was doing to my soul. Like, it was just like tearing at me. I was waking up in the middle of the night thinking about those sales. Like, oh, if I would have said this, I might have been able to manipulate them to actually buy the computer. They don't just need the computer; they need a printer and virus protection and 4-year warranty. And we'll call it a manager special, right? These are what salesmen do. They come up with these things, and it was killing me. And so I was just ready to get out of there as quick as possible. The anxiety was terrible. But what would happen if Michael Dell, the owner of Dell, said, "Hey, Slim, you've been doing a great job. I want you to just, don't worry about sales. I want you to just come into my family. In fact, I want to adopt you." Now that one be a little weird, right? Like, okay, it's a little crossing some boundaries. But if the owner of Dell said, I want you to adopt you into my family, and you now, you don't have to earn your spot to stay with us, you're there. Now just come to work and have a good time. To come to work and work it out. Like, it would change everything, yes? It would change how you approach your work. It would change everything. And I want you to see here today, when we come to Romans 4, what Paul is going to tell us in Romans 4, it changes everything. It changes everything of how we see God, how we approach the faith in such drastic terms as if you're adopted into Michael Dell's family. Sorry, Michael Dell. So here's what we're talking about today. The title of my sermon here is, Good People Don't Go to Heaven? Interesting. Good people don't go to heaven. And so the way we're going to talk about here is this. Faith works in the God of the impossible. Faith works in the God of the impossible. So first, let's talk about faith. Faith. Paul begins this passage. He's quoting from Genesis 15. This whole passage is being been weighted by what's happening in Genesis 15. And he's talking about Abraham, who's known as like the father of our faith. And so he says this in verse 3. He says, Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. How many of y'all believe God? Hopefully, every hand. How many of y'all believe Jesus is Lord? Yes, how many of y'all believe Jesus died for your sins? Fantastic. What does it mean that you believe? What does it mean when you say, I believe God? I actually believe in these things. Is it like a mere mental, intellectual exercise to say like, yeah, I sounds logical. I approve that message. Is that what we're saying? It's like if I were to tell you, do you believe that Neil Armstrong landed on the moon? Some of us go, was it Neil Armstrong or was it a different guy? Was Neil Armstrong the first man on the moon? Yes, he was. Now, do you believe that? Some of you are going, I think so. Now, when we say, I believe Neil Armstrong, or you can say, I believe George Washington was the very first president, you go like, yeah, I believe that. I assume that's right. But what does it mean? Are you willing to bank your eternity on that? Some of us are doubting whether Neil Armstrong was the first man on the moon already. So we're not willing to bank that. But I think the way we say, I believe in Jesus, is the same as you saying, I believe George Washington was the first president. You're going like, yeah, I'll accept that that's true. Is that enough? Is that what is called saving faith? I would argue it's not. And I would say, case in point, there were many, many years of my life that I went to church and I would say that I am a Christian when I wasn't a Christian. Many of us probably have gone to church for many, many years and say, I believe in God, but it wasn't until you actually hit that moment where you said, oh, now I truly believe. Now I understand belief is something more than just mental assent and saying, yes, I affirm that's true. Something's changed. Something's different. Let me see if I can illustrate it this way for you. Can I have one very brave volunteer? Who wants to? Come on up. Yeah. Let's give a round of applause. Love it. Love it. Thank you. Yeah, come on up on stage. All right. What is your name?
I'm Hannah.
Hannah. Is the mic okay working? Sorry, I did not prep our sound team on that one. We're taking our time. That's my fault. Okay. We're going to have you speak loudly.
My name is Hannah.
Say hi, Hannah. I think the mic's not working. Let's try it now. There we go. All right, okay. Hannah. Do you see this object over here?
Sure.
Do you believe? She's already doubtful. This is going to be perfect. Do you believe this is a chair?
Yes.
Yes. Do you believe this chair can hold your weight?
I do.
Is the chair holding your weight?
Not right now.
Why not?
I'm not sitting in it.
Oh, you're not sitting in it. Interesting. In that case, Hannah, will you go sit in the chair?
Can I check it out first? I feel like you did something to it.
I think you just need to see what happens. All right, the attention is building. Yeah!
You wouldn't embarrass me on stage?
That is everything. That is everything. Thank you for sitting in a chair. Hannah, when you get home and people say, how was church today? And you say, well, you know, I sat in a chair. And they're just going to be like, what? What kind of church is this? Amazing. The reason we did that is because I wanted to illustrate a point. That we can say we have saving faith without actually ever believing in Jesus. We can say, yeah, that chair can hold me. But it's not until you actually sit down, when you saw the fear of like, well, I don't know, is this going to hold? And we think we all held that fear, going like, is Slim really going to mess with this poor person? Right? I would not do that. Right? But we all have that fear. Until you actually sit down and put your weight into it and say, I trust, I'm banking everything on this, then we are not actually believing in Jesus. We're just saying, yes, Neil Armstrong was the first man on the moon. There's a very different form of belief. This is what he says, and he believed, and it was credited to him as righteousness. When you sit down in the chair, that's true belief, and God credits to you righteousness. That term there is a very financial term, as if you just opened your bank account and you saw like all this money. You got credited all of this money, all this righteousness, all this right standing with God. It's not just saying you nod your head and go, I affirm that's true. There's something more to it. And so some of us have maybe made a profession of faith before at a church. At the end of church, you said, hey, with all eyes closed, raise your hand if you want to put your faith in Jesus. Or maybe you walked the aisle. I'm glad you did that. You professed your faith. But I want you to hear, a profession of faith does not save you. Just saying, I believe, does not save you. It's not the profession that matters. It's the possession of the faith that matters. If you possess the faith, then yes, you should profess it. But there are many in church who profess faith that have never sat in the chair, that have never actually possessed real faith. And if you possess real faith, it is like dynamite inside you. It changes you. It makes you want to live differently. And this is when we get into the relationship that Paul wants to draw out in Romans 4 between faith and works. And so we talked about faith, this belief, but now let's talk about works. And so Paul is obsessed with this question. How do you have faith and works? How do those things work together? And he says this in verse 2. He says, if in fact Abraham was justified by works, he had something to boast about, but not before God. And then jump to verse 4. Now to the one who works, wages are not credited as a gift, but as an obligation. So what he's trying to say here is, if you go to work and your employer says, you know, this month I'm feeling generous and I think I will give you your salary. You would probably say, this feels very manipulative. No, you are not being generous. I worked. I spent 40 hours this week. You owe it to me. And that's what he's saying. They're obligated to pay you. And so faith has this element here of like works. So you're saying, is it grace? Is it work? Well, he's saying your faith is not something God owes you. It's grace. Because if you were to tell your boss, no, you owe me something, that really now your boss is in your debt. And Paul would say, it is absurd for us to say that God is in our debt, that God owes us anything here. No, it's a gift. And we don't want to hear it in that way, because many of us, we live in this culture and we want to say like, no, I've obeyed, I've sacrificed, I gave. God should reward those things. You guys ever feel like you have to prove yourself in different spheres of life? You have to prove yourself at work. Like, I've got to show up, I've got to earn this. Maybe in your marriage, you feel like you have to prove yourself. Maybe at school. Sometimes even in church, we feel like we have to prove ourselves. I'm worried some of that performance culture has bled into our view of our faith with God. That we say, like, I've got to show that I can make an impact. That I've got to hit the numbers. I've got to have a good return on investment for God. And that is so anti-scripture. Because I want to say this. You cannot earn what God gives. That's the whole heart thrust of chapter 4, that you cannot earn what God gives. He's given it to you freely. You can't earn it. It's a gift. And so then for those who are worried that are wondering whether they can earn this faith, verse 5 is just a devastating blow to you. Verse 5 says, God justifies the ungodly. What a word, the ungodly. It didn't say God justifies the impressive. It didn't say God justifies even the good people. He didn't even say God justifies the decent people. He says the ungodly. Like if you were to come home today and you were to say, yeah, a girl sat in a chair. It was great. But also, kids were baptized. And someone said, tell me about these kids being baptized. Were they funny? Were they cute? Like how old? And your response was, the kids were ungodly. What a way to describe human beings. They were ungodly. Now some of our family's like, don't you describe my kids that way. They're not ungodly, they're precious. Some of us know that our kids are ungodly. But for all of us, we need to hear that this is who God justifies. He doesn't justify the perfect, the impressive. He justifies the ungodly. It is wild. He's saying, I'm going to make right the outcasts, the pariahs, the absolute worst of us. Oh, man. And for many of us, I think maybe we were like, yeah, that sounds okay. That sounds good news. But secretly, I've heard from many people throughout the years who have a works-based view of their relationship with God. And it comes out in this way. And they say, man, I don't get it. I was a good kid. Maybe they're getting disillusioned with their spot in life. Like, I was a good kid. I didn't lie, I didn't cheat, I didn't steal, I didn't mess around before marriage. And now this is the life God gave me? I don't know if you ever felt that before. In that sense, you're trying to say, God, you owe me. And God's saying, I don't owe anyone. This is all a gift. It is by grace and grace alone. And we, for some of us, that feels very offensive. It also feels like nonsense. But we want it to be the best news in the world. Now, we can see why it might be offensive if you call anyone ungodly. That feels kind of offensive. But why would it be nonsense? Well, there are other parts of the Bible that feel like this passage directly contradicts. James, who is Jesus' brother, who you think knows Jesus pretty well, he has a passage in James 2 that feels like it's a direct contradiction to this passage. So James 2 says this, and he's talking about Abraham. And he says, you see that a person is considered righteous by what they do and not by faith alone. So one verse says you are considered righteous because God declared it. You didn't earn it. Otherwise, that would be a wage. This passage says something very hard for us to hear. Maybe we've grown up and heard you're saved by grace alone and faith alone. He says you are not saved, that you're saved by what you do and not by faith alone. Can we put that back up there? I'm surprised this verse is in the Bible. Is anyone surprised this verse is in the Bible? I feel like this was one that I'm like, are we certain that this is in the Bible? You are saved not by faith alone? I feel like that's on every church's website. You are saved by faith alone. And you're saved by what you do? Ooh. Now, how do you square that circle? How do we deal with that? I don't think the Bible contradicts itself. One idea is to follow the Martin Luther path. Early Martin Luther said this, James is an epistle of straw. That epistle, this letter, does not belong in the canon of the New Testament. This was early Martin Luther. He later repented of this and said, no, I'm sorry about that. But he was trying to make sense of this. Like these feel like two contradictory things. One says you're saved by what God does. One says you're saved by what you do. Which one is it? And this is the thing that theologians have fought over and thought over for millions of years. Not millions, thousands of years, right? Billions. All right. Thank you. Here's my, I think what's maybe a helpful way to understand this. I think the key comes in the chronology of how Abraham received, how he received God's blessing and saying, I'm giving you righteousness, and then he changes. So in Genesis 15 is when Abraham gets the promise that he's going to declare Abraham righteous. But it's not until Genesis 17 does Abraham actually follow up, and he gets circumcised. And circumcision was this sign of being part of God's community, being part of this of the kingdom in this way. It was an outworking of works. And so he believed, and then he worked. He believed, and then works came, right? It's not the other way around. It wasn't he worked, and then he believed. It's because he believes that is why he worked. And so what Paul is trying to do by identifying our faith in this chapter, not with David, not with Moses, he's saying, I'm going to identify our faith with Abraham, the OG, the original, the father of our faith. The reason I'm identifying our faith with Abraham was because this is before we even had the law. We didn't even know what the law was. The Ten Commandments hadn't even come yet. So it could have been through that obedience. It couldn't have been through circumcision. It was by grace and grace alone that it was given to Abraham. And Abraham wasn't the Israelite nation. And so Abraham, he's going to make you the father of all nations. It's starting with the Gentiles, then you're going to have the Israelites, and then it's going to go to the end of the nations, to the Gentiles. And so there's this picture of this multi-ethnic kingdom where everyone's going to be brought back in. And so you are saved by grace and grace alone, but that grace is never alone. That grace actually makes you want to work. That grace actually produces work out of you. And so, yes, we can affirm, James, that grace is never alone, that you are saved by your works, because it's a response to what Jesus has worked in you first. Does that make sense? If it doesn't, great. This has been the whole thing that people fight over all the time. Here's how one way I think it might be helpful to say it this way. Religion says, I obey, and therefore I'm accepted. The gospel says, I'm accepted, and therefore I obey. I think some of us may go like, yeah, I don't want to be known as religious, but you kind of get that first one, that I obey and therefore I'm accepted. If I do the right things, then I can control how I'm accepted in certain spaces, even in God's presence. But the gospel says, no, you're accepted. You belong before you even obey. It's the difference between a company saying you have to work like a salesman and earn your place, or a family saying, hey, you're welcome to come home for Thanksgiving this year. We'll have a spot for you at the table. You belong, and therefore you obey. Therefore, you follow up, and you go to the Thanksgiving, right? This is the big difference between what the gospel does. The gospel is to the moral achiever. We want to say to you, it's not about you. It's about Jesus. The gospel is going to humble you. But to the moral failure, who feels excluded, it's not about you. The gospel is going to invite you, because God justifies the ungodly. So, how do we square all this? You have faith, you have works. How does this all work? Let's talk about the God of the impossible. The God of the impossible. Our God does impossible things. Our God does crazy things. When did Abraham believe? When he was young? When he was ready to have kids? Teenager, 20s, 30s? He wasn't until 90 when he was told he would have kids. Some of us wanting to have kids cannot have kids. Are wondering at a certain age, you go, I don't think it's going to happen for us. At 90, you're like, no, it's not in the cards for us. That's okay. You've come to accept it at that point. And God gives this promise. It almost sounds cruel. No, this is for you. And he says, you're going to have as many kids as there are stars in the sky. In Genesis 15, he says, look up at the sky and count the stars, if indeed you can count them. Then he said to him, so shall your offspring be. Millions and billions of stars. Abraham and Sarah, you who have zero kids, you're going to have as many kids as there are stars in the sky. How many of you would doubt that promise? Yeah. Like, no, that can't be real. I misinterpreted what God said. This is not a real promise. How many of us would doubt and have that doubt creep into all of our life? I think that doubt has crept in many other ways for us, because we weren't given that promise. We've been given other promises that we start to doubt. But God makes the promise to Abraham and Sarah, and then they have a child, and they name him Isaac. And Isaac means laughter, because when they first got that promise, they laughed. They're like, yeah, sure, we're going to have a kid. They didn't have the kid until Abraham was 100 years old. So they even had to wait 10 years before that promise came to fruition. I'm sure the doubt crept in again. Like, did we really hear God say that? And God came on that promise, and they named him Isaac, because they laughed the first time, but now they're laughing the second time because they're going, God is so good. And if you've ever seen God do amazing things, do impossible things, one of the best responses is just to laugh and just go, I can't believe it. God is so good. I cannot believe he's doing that. And some of us are, as we see baptisms, we're just laughing. We're like, that's amazing that God is saving and working in these ways. It's a wonderful thing. And so God says in verse 17, as it is written, I have made you a father of many nations. He is our father in the sight of God in whom he had believed, the God who gives life to the dead and calls into being things that were not. Who gives life to the dead. Who can bring life out of death. Like Jesus, he was raised from the dead. The same power that raises Jesus from the dead is the same power that's at work within us now. It's the same resurrection power that Jesus was walking around with, where he was raising the dead, where he was casting out demons, where he was healing the sick. That same resurrection power isn't just about getting us from death to life into heaven, that same resurrection power is at work in this life now, where God can actually bring to life dead things. And I don't know if some of you guys need to hear some of this here today. As some of us might be wondering, there might be a place in our life, some pains in our life, where something feels dead. Or maybe a relationship feels dead. Maybe your faith feels gone. And your hope feels dry, like I don't even know how to hope in this environment. And for all of us, I want you to hear that we have a God who specializes in bringing dead things back to life. Like, he can do miraculous things, and we can all testify. You may have seen it before, but then you doubt that it's good for you. You doubt that it's true for you. And so our God doesn't need strong people. It's not on your strength. It's on your surrender, saying, like, Lord, work through this. Lord, I want you to show up in my weakness here. Because the same God who brought Sarah's womb to life is the same God who brings Jesus back from the dead. And so what is the promise that God has given us here today? He's not promised us, like Abraham, that we're going to have millions of kids. That's not the promise we've been given. But what are some promises God has given us? And you can look through the scriptures and look at those promises. Let me just give you three. In 1 Corinthians 15, Paul says this: "For what I received, I passed on to you as of first importance, that one, Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures." In this small little passage here is the promise that Jesus died and was buried for our sins, and that he was raised. Do you believe this? This is like the basics of the Christian faith. Do we believe this, that Jesus died for my sins? Do we believe that, or do we believe it like we believe Neil Armstrong on the moon? What would it mean for us to truly believe that Jesus died for my sins? I think we like to hedge our bets. We're like, yeah, I would love to believe that. But just in case, we have what Tony Evans calls the mutual fund faith, where we want to diversify. We want to not put all of our eggs into one basket. And we say, I want to believe that, but just in case he didn't die for my sins, that I need to earn it. I need to show off and show up and prove myself before God. Oh man, that is like running on a treadmill that will never arrive. And some of us may be feeling like that. We feel like we've been running on a treadmill and never arriving and never feeling like we actually truly belong in God's family. Don't doubt that promise. What about the promise that God raised Jesus from the dead? And if God raised Jesus from the dead, then he raises us from the dead too. That's the promise. And how many of us truly believe that? And we actually sat down in that promise and say, no, I actually believe that when I die, I'm going to be brought back to life. If you truly believe that, then we would stop gripping this world for all that it is and saying, I have to live this life to its fullest. I have to pull everything out of every situation, every place I'm at, because I won't get it in the age to come. I would love for there to be a heaven, but I don't think there's going to be, and so I'm just going to make sure this life is all that there is. I don't know if we're fully sitting in the chair yet on our belief that we're going to be raised from the dead. If we were, then we wouldn't be so afraid of death. And we wouldn't be trying to suck everything out of every part of life. We'd be happy for other people, saying, I'm just happy for you. I'm glad you got to go visit Japan. Maybe one day I will, but maybe that'll also be in the new heavens and new earth. I'll get a chance to go visit. Whatever it may be, we have eternity to explore the world. Do we believe we get to do it? And so you cannot watch the Christian faith from the sidelines. If you want to say that God's crediting to you righteousness, you actually have to sit in the chair. You actually say, Jesus, I believe. So what's my so what to you as you go out this week? The so what here are three things. First, check your biases. If God justifies the ungodly, who are we to exclude anyone? Who are the people that we are tempted to exclude and say, I don't know, they might be too messy for church? God justifies the ungodly. God justifies you. So of course, no one's too messy. So if there is that person or there's that group of people, I want you to commit this week to pray for them. pray for them, not against them, for them, for their good, for their health, for their blessing. And then invite them to dinner if you can, or invite them to church. All this is not for you to fix them. It's for you to welcome them the way God would welcome them. So first, check your biases. Secondly, check yourself before you wreck yourself. Meaning, check your motivations. Am I working to belong, or am I working from belonging? Do I know that I'm accepted by God, and therefore I'm like, yeah, I'll go out and I'll go to the World Hunger Relief Farm? Or am I going to these things and serving in ways that say, like, this is, maybe God will love me a little bit more? Let's check our motivations here. Grace, you're saved by grace and grace alone, but that grace is never alone. And then thirdly, sit in the chair. I hope this image, thank you for illustrating that for us. I hope this image is able to be like burned in your retinas and you can think about this in this way. Because I think many in church, not just this church, I think many in the American church say, I believe in God, but are still never, ever even attempting to sit. They're still on the question of whether they can trust that it is a chair. Right? So can we say, I believe, and if I do, then I'm going to put my whole weight into Jesus. That's going to change your life drastically at school, at work, at home, in small groups, your discipleship, all of it, your prayer life. Like, are we sitting in the chair? Do we actually believe? Now, for some of us, maybe you say, like, I actually have never put my hope and faith in Jesus, and I want to do that today. I would love to pray with you, and we'll have a little time to pray. You pray with us. But some of us were like, yeah, I made that prayer, but I'm not really believing in Jesus. I still have my doubts. That's okay. That's like the father who gets rebuked by Jesus, and he says, I believe, but help my unbelief. And so let's all recommit to sitting in the chair and to believing in this way.